It's Friday, July 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hi, and welcome. Coming up, Greece reaches a short-term financial bailout deal.
You cannot just simply reinterpret the Constitution willy-nilly. It has to be done properly.
Japan moves to loosen restraints on its military. Also ahead, Pluto becomes larger through new photos, and we gain a new perspective of a former singing star. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Before we talk about Greece, we'd like to pass along some breaking news. Four U.S. Marines have been killed in shootings at two military facilities in the southern state of Tennessee. Officials there say the gunman who opened fire at the two facilities was also killed in that incident. Several other people were wounded. Law enforcement sources say the shooter is identified as 24-year-old Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz. An FBI source tells VOA he was Kuwaiti and was a naturalized U.S. citizen. Of course, as this story develops, we will have more right here on International Edition. Greece won a financial lifeline on Thursday from its European neighbors, with Eurozone finance chiefs agreeing to hand Athens a short-term loan to meet its immediate debts and also open talks on a new three-year $94 billion bailout. The finance ministers in Europe's 19-nation euro currency bloc took the actions just hours after Greek lawmakers approved tough austerity reforms demanded by Athens creditors. The pension cuts and tax increases were adopted after a contentious debate inside Parliament and police clashes with anti-austerity protesters outside. And at the same time, the central bank said it would raise the cap on its emergency funding for Greek banks by $978 million, which may allow them to reopen soon after they've been shut for 2 weeks. The banks were closed for a fear of a run on deposits as debt-racked Greece neared a financial collapse while negotiating terms of its new austerity for cash deal. We wanted to find out more, so our Jeffrey Young asked Peterson Institute for International Economics senior fellow Jacob Kierkegaard, just what is this bridge loan that the EU is giving Greece?
A bridge loan is basically an advance that Greece is getting for a much bigger loan or much bigger bailout that will be negotiated in the coming weeks and months. So this is essentially just a cash advance that allows Greece to pay a number of bills that it have falling due in the coming weeks, including, in fact, to EU institutions like the ECB itself.
Can you explain some of the things that Greece had to do to get the EU to advance this money?
Yes, basically in the last couple of weeks and months, there has an acute trust deficit has emerged between the Greek government and its European partners. So what the European basically told the Greeks is that you have to do a very large amount of the reforms up front in order to get this bridge loans, and that includes things like reforming the pension system. It involves further liberalizing the Greek labor market. It involves signing up for establishment of a new, potentially far-reaching privatization fund so that you can make sure that the Greek government actually carries through the kind of privatization of state assets that it needs. So this was no doubt a politically very, very difficult vote for the Greek government to pass.
As evidenced by the fact that on Wednesday, we saw mass demonstrations in Athens. Apparently, a lot of people were upset.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that this vote in the Greek parliament was a remarkable U-turn for a government that just 2 weeks ago campaigned actively in a public referendum for the Greek people to reject a bailout that was actually less harsh than the one the government now had to pass through parliament. But, of course, the big difference that happened in the meantime was that the Europeans basically told the Greeks that unless they did this, they would be outside of the common currency, and that threat clearly worked.
Is there any sort of a timeline if the reforms demanded by the Eurozone are put into place? How long is it going to be before Greece is realistically back on its feet?
There's no doubt that that will take years, but that doesn't change the fact that there's actually significant carrots to Greece in this agreement, because it is for the first time, in my opinion, including what I would call credible offers from the Eurozone to the Greek government of further debt restructuring and indeed debt relief. And that, in my opinion, will come as soon as probably early next year.
Well, now that we've heard from one expert, it's time for us to turn to another. G. Abby Lee joins me here in Studio 22, and she's been checking out the public's reaction on the web. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. As we just heard in the Q&A, Athens basically did a 180 from 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And not surprisingly, many Greek citizens are not thrilled about that decision. And leading up to the bridge loan announcement Thursday, there were two main hashtags on Twitter.
Well, tell us about the first one.
Sure, it's hashtag this is a coup, and that was the second most used hashtag in the world Sunday. It was used by commentators lashing out at what they viewed as an unfair deal for Greece. And as you know, Greece was running out of cash and desperate for a deal, so that was forcing the government to negotiate from a position of weakness.
So, gee, how prevalent is that sentiment on the web?
The social media analytics website Topsy shows that the hashtag was used almost 2,000 times during the last 24 hours. And during the last 7 days, it was used in around 470,000 tweets. But recently, that hashtag was replaced by a new one.
Oh, what is that? And how is it different from the previous hashtag?
The replacing hashtag was hashtag Tsipras Leave EU Summit. This was not as popular and definitely more specific than the previous one. That hashtag was specifically designed to urge the Greek Prime Minister, Alexander Tsipras, to step out of the EU summit. Some Twitter users used both hashtags and said, it's not about leaving the Eurozone or not. They argued it's about humility or dignity.
At 144 characters, both hashtags would take up most of your tweet, but it looks like some people were taking this quite personally.
Oh, absolutely. And that's because, you know, even though foreign and economic policies are not designed to be taken that way, people do take them personally. If you think about it, national pride is personal, money is personal, and how the public perceives these decisions have a real impact on the world economy and diplomacy.
Well, that Greek journey has definitely been a roller coaster for many people, for sure. Thank you for that update, G. G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. How about that? This is VOA News, and this is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Japan's lower house of parliament has approved legislation that will loosen restraints on the military. It's controversial, and the measure passed Thursday with the support of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition despite some massive protests and a boycott by the main opposition parties. Opposition lawmakers are upset that Mr. Abe's Liberal Democratic Party pushed that legislation through without what they consider a sufficient discussion. International Edition host Sarah Williams spoke with Michael Cusack, an adjunct professor at Sophia University in Tokyo and a fellow in Asian studies at Temple University in Japan.
This was something that was pushed by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Has this been sort of in the works, you know, for a while now?
The idea that Japan should contribute more to its security by cooperating with other countries has been in the works since the early 1990s. The embarrassment felt at Japan's inability to participate in the Gulf War led to a lot of thinking and talking here about what Japan can do. Now, gradually and slowly, Japan's ability to work with other countries has been expanding. But Mr. Abe wanted to really push the process forward, and so last year, asked his government, and his cabinet approved, a possibility of reinterpreting the Constitution, allowing Japan to participate fully in collective self-defense.
But this has been met with a lot of opposition by members of other parties. Could this create more of a divide within Japanese domestic politics?
It has already created a tremendous divide. The opposition parties are only a minor part of the opposition to the actions of the government. It is deeply unpopular with the public, with the voters, not necessarily because of a sense that Japan is on a march toward war, though there is a small minority that would argue that, but for basically the sense that you cannot just simply reinterpret the Constitution willy-nilly. It has to be done properly. And in the case of the reinterpretation that has taken place, it goes against 50 years of prime ministers and their administrations stating unequivocally that collective self-defense is unconstitutional. What Mr. Abe and his party have done is say, no, we've changed our minds. That, for many people, is a violation of the compact that exists between politicians and the rest of the country, that you cannot just do whatever you want to do. You have to do things right.
So why is this movement or this change coming now? Is it because of China's rising military strength?
It's for two reasons. One is, yes, the concerns that Japan's security environment is deteriorating. And the second concern is that with the relationship of the United States, there has to be some kind of rectification of what has been a long-standing asymmetry.
Michael Kuchek is an adjunct professor at Sophia University in Tokyo, also a fellow in Asian studies at Temple University in Japan. Well, whether you're in Japan or here in the United States or anywhere else in the world where you have access to the internet through a computer or your mobile phone or perhaps even television and newspapers, you've probably seen some stunning photographs of Pluto. The U.S. space agency NASA is now releasing more long-awaited photos from its New Horizons mission that show icy mountains on the surface of that dwarf planet. VOA's Susan Yockey discusses the mission with Dr. Jorge Nunez, planetary scientists with the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab.
The U.S. space agency NASA is releasing long-awaited photos from its New Horizons mission, and we're all excited about Pluto and what we're seeing on Pluto. Joining us on the line is Dr. Jorge Nunez. He's a planetary scientist with Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, and his specialty is lenses. And I want to welcome you, Doctor, to our program, and we really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us what the pictures look like?
There's a variety of pictures that have obviously been presented and released. And so one of them that has come back is a full image of Charon, which is just fantastic. So it's a very similar image to what we saw with Lori that was shown on Tuesday, revealed on Tuesday.
What are you saying? I guess the names I'm not familiar with.
Oh, so Charon is one of the moons.
Ah.
So it's the largest moon of Pluto. And so we basically, with this flyby, we turned a point of light into a full moon, and with Pluto, obviously, into a planet. And so what we're seeing is that these bodies are just incredibly complex and very different. And so with the view of Charon, we see that there's a dark spot right near the pole, and also that there's this big canyon almost 1,000 kilometers wide that runs right along near the near the middle of the equator. And so we see that it's also, the surface is also very relatively young. The same thing with the highest resolution image that came down of Pluto.
How can you tell their age from looking at the surface?
So if you look at the image of the moon, you see that there's a lot of craters on the surface, and the same thing with Mars. And so we use, so what planetary scientists do is they obviously we can't date the rocks.
We can't date them yet, is what you mean.
Well, exactly. We can't date them yet. Exactly. Well, we do have some meteorites that have come back. We know now that we have meteorites from the surface of Mars as well as surface from the moon. And so we can date those rocks. But primarily, when we were exploring unexplored worlds, so for example, like with Pluto, what we use is we look at craters, and so we, by counting the number of craters, and especially the size of the craters, it tells us information about how old the surface is. And so the greater the number of craters you see on the surface, most likely the older the surface is. So what we're seeing with the surface of Pluto is that even though Pluto has been around probably since the formation of the solar system around 4.56 billion years ago, we're seeing that not many craters. And so what that tells us is that some activity is, geologic activity is resurfacing the surface of Pluto, thereby wiping away any potential, any remnants of any craters that we see. And so some of the estimates that were presented yesterday is that it could be as young as 100 million years ago.
It's all so exciting and interesting. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And good luck with your project.
All right, thank you very much.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
British singer and five-time Grammy winner Amy Winehouse died 4 years ago at age 27. There's a new documentary that tells her story in her own words and those of the people around her. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Shauna Renee about Amy.
Shauna, this movie is something that gives a... First of all, the director is Asif Kapadia, and he doesn't use any narration. He just uses archival film of Amy Winehouse's life.
Correct. He allows Amy and the people around Amy to tell her story. And there is no narrative there other than what she explains of herself, other than what we see her go through from very young. It starts when she's a very young girl, I think 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And then it goes all the way up until, you know, her unfortunate demise.
Now, she died from alcohol poisoning.
Yes.
She had a problem with, I think the movie brings this out, she had a problem with an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
She also had problems with alcohol and drugs.
And drugs, yes.
And, of course, her most famous pop hit was Rehab.
Right.
Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, you'll know, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, he's trying to make me go to rehab. I won't go.
The more famous she got, the less intimate the movie is. And it's really, it's kind of sad. It's a sad portrayal of somebody who said all she was ever going to be was a singer.
Yeah. And I think it's indicative of life in that realm, the life of a celebrity. The more famous they become, the more sort of internal and alone and lonely they become because they don't know who they can trust.
Mm.
They're not sure whether or not the people who are in their immediate circle can be people that they trust. And she kind of deals with that a little bit. In the footage, she's asked questions about, do you know who you can trust? Do you have people around you who you can trust. Even her husband's, the relationship she had with her husband was called into question. He was said to be enabling her alcoholism and maybe to a lesser degree her drug use.
Right.
And that was supposed to be the most intimate relationship that she had.
And there was a relationship, kind of a semi-toxic relationship with her dad. And with her manager, they were both kind of... One thing I've heard about this movie is it shows how the people around her never really talked to one another.
Right.
They talked to her, but they never really talked to one another about her to get her the help that she needed. And it's really sad because she died at 27 years old.
Yeah. And her father is not very happy with this movie. Her father has come out publicly and said that he doesn't believe she would have appreciated the way that she's being portrayed in this movie. And he certainly doesn't appreciate the way he's being portrayed in this movie as someone who had no clue, no concern for what was going on in her life.
Well, the documentary is called Amy, and it opens in wide release here in the United States this week?
This weekend, yes. And one of the interesting things about this from a musical perspective is that now people who may not have been familiar with her music or forgot about it are downloading it. So her albums are seeing a resurgence of popularity. And I just think it's a beautiful thing because she was such a talented musician and singer and songwriter. So at least she gets a second life, if you will.
If you want to send Shauna a message on Twitter, she is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. We, of course, are at VOA underscore IE.
I'm done.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com, where you will also find all of the latest breaking news and developments. We thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Our director is Tracy Carter and our engineer, Dan Crafton. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
By the end of 2015, the Millennium Development Goals, or MDG, the United Nations' 15-year plan to cut global poverty by half, will run out of time. So the UN is drawing up the Sustainable Development Goals program, which is meant to succeed the MDGs and to consolidate their gains. Like its predecessor, the Sustainable Development Goals program identifies poverty as humanity's greatest challenge and sets its elimination in all its forms as top priority. Other goals include the promotion of people's well-being through better health, education, nutrition, empowerment, and gender equality, to name a few. All these goals, said Michelle Sisson, U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, can be more easily achieved by promoting Goal 16, the rule of law. That's because when a society adheres to the rule of law and citizens become better able to make their voices heard, society becomes more committed to living by the rule of law. But when the law is selectively applied or written in such a way as to disadvantage certain segments of society, everyone loses. For instance, most smallholder farmers are women. But in many countries, laws discriminate against women by not allowing them to inherit land, sign legal contracts, or access financial services, thus depriving them of access to needed equipment and better seeds. Changing these laws to provide women codified and equal rights to land tenure would increase food production. Studies have shown that securing and recognizing women's land rights can increase agricultural productivity and shared household decision-making, and thereby help lift families out of poverty, said Ambassador Sisson. Similarly, laws that protect civil society from oppression could help generate new ideas and encourage entrepreneurship. Laws promoting transparency would diminish corruption, improve economic activity, and restore citizens' faith in their leaders. And all such changes would support other key elements of the development agenda. The rule of law promotes respect for freedoms of expression and association, transparency, and facilitating access to justice, said Ambassador Sisson. With respect to each of these principles, freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, transparency and access to justice, The rule of law impels societies ever forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.